Welcome to the Movies on the Brain podcast. I am your host for the evening, Brian C. Wood. From all of us at the Movies on the Brain podcast, we'd like to wish you a very, very Merry Christmas and a happy holiday season to all of you. We at the Movies on the Brain podcast are very thankful for you and for your listenership over this past year. Me and Chad would like to extend our heartfelt thank you to T-Bob Hebert for joining us on several editions of the show this year, as well as Mr. Jim Vavida of IGN, who was kind enough to grace us with his presence a couple of times as well. We look forward to many more great and interesting and thought-provoking conversations over the course of the next year. As you know, we're already over 100 episodes, past the 100 episode mark earlier this year, and we hope to be around for many, many episodes to come. So, while this is not going to be our year-end podcast, me and Chad will sit down and we will hash out the year of movie news, and we will talk about those films that we liked, those films that we didn't, and those films that we are most looking forward to come 2018. I have a funny feeling the name Black Panther will be one of the first off the list. But tonight is something different. As I sit here on this Christmas Eve with a TMNT glass in my hand and a warm fire on my television, I wanted to let the world know that I have seen Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, and I wanted to provide my thoughts on Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. So this will in fact be a solo, unedited, unaltered, unfiltered conversation about Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. If you have not seen Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, you can stop listening now and pick this episode of the podcast back up after you and your family have seen this wonderful soon-to-be holiday classic. For those of you who have, be prepared to go on a very nice and enjoyable ride as we delve deep into what worked, what I would have changed, and what I flat-out didn't like about this movie, and what I think the state of the Jumanji franchise, such as it is in going forward. So let's start off this conversation with what I enjoyed most about the film. So the thing I enjoyed most about this film is its humor. This movie is buoyed by its cast and its chemistry. This was some of the best casting you will ever see for a comedy. All of the actors, the key to a teen movie, the key to a coming-of-age story, is the chemistry of your core cast. One of the reasons that Freaks and Geeks works so well for the 16 to 18 episodes that it exists is the fact that those characters are not only played by really great actors, but they also have great chemistry between each other. The main group of three boys who were nerds in Freaks and Geeks work well together. Franco and Rogan and their little clique of friends bounce off each other and work really well together. Linda Carlini and her best friend work well off of each other. And they all interact, even the parents interact with their kids in a way that feels natural and feels spontaneous and feels organic and just has a warmth onto it that kind of invites you in. And that's a lot of what a great movie, especially a family-friendly or a teen-centric or a coming-of-age movie does, is it draws you in with the connections between the kids. One of the reasons that the John Hughes movies are so transcendent is because those cast work, especially in Breakfast Club, really, really well. And this cast on Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, works really well together. Now, there was some built-in chemistry here already. The Rock and Kevin Hart, having done a couple of movies already together, had a rapport and a connection, and that movie was not that long ago. So, you know, they had this timing and rapport already down. Jack Black is very much in his element here, channeling the inner 2010s teenage girl. The phone consumed, Instagram posting, Insta-famous, Snapchatter girl who, you know, thinks she's all that. And Karen Gillian does a remarkable job showing her comedic chops. She really embodies, I'd argue, better than any of the rest of the cast, their character, both in the young form and in the adult form. I love that she plays with the expectations of her as a femme fatale, which is a reputation that she's enjoyed pretty much since Guardians of the Galaxy. And I love how they kind of, you know, flirt with those expectations, subvert those expectations, if you will. The young cast is really likable, too. We don't get a whole lot of time, obviously being a body switch movie taking place in the world of Jumanji. The young cast only gets the beginning of the half of the first act and the last half of the third act. And so, you know, we don't get a lot of time with them, but their chemistry is really good too. They really sell a lot of the personality traits that are going to blend over into the adult versions of the characters. So the cast was really, the cast and the cast chemistry was some of the best things about this film. It just worked really, really well on a lot of levels, for me personally, and I think for the film as a whole. Another thing that really works well for this film is the message of it, the message of the film itself. Film, we talk a lot on this podcast about film as literature, and reading film as literature, and film and art being an interpretive medium, and therefore being up for debate or discussion. The message that a filmmaker or a studio or an actor is trying to present is very important, because it goes to the author's intent. And so when you get a piece like The Post, which is Steven Spielberg's movie about the Pentagon Papers, well, it's being made in reaction to the Trump administration. It's being made in an environment where the press is fairly or unfairly always under attack. It's, you know, speaking truth to power, and it's not made in a film that's made in a vacuum. It's a product of its environment, and the statement and the message that Spielberg is trying to persuade his audience with, or the message he's trying to persuade his audience with, is one that, you know, look, you know, the freedom of the press is very important. Speaking truth to power is very important. Being willing to go to jail for what you believe in, and having that kind of fundamental belief in what you feel, is important. And we need to remind ourselves of these Watergate era values that we had as a country, that we essentially took our country back. You know, we you know, protested in the streets. You know, we created a movement to get the Civil Rights Act of 1968 passed. We created a movement against the Vietnam War, and we ultimately, in the sentiment within the country, and ultimately Walter Cronkite turning, caused the administration of Nixon to make changes to our policy in regards to Vietnam. We need to have that kind of energy, that kind of forward momentum again, because one of our great institutions, the press, their freedom and our freedom are being attacked, and we need to stand up, and we need to get moving in the same way we were moving in the late 60s, early 70s to speak truth to power. You can agree with that message or not, and you can say that message in The Post is dictated in a overt fashion, in a preachy fashion, or you can say it's done tactfully and smartly impassionately. Neither opinion is wrong, but that's the message Spielberg, along with his writers and his actors, is trying to convey. In this particular instance, the writers and the actors, especially The Rock, I feel, in this film, are trying to portray the message to the coming generation of take pride in yourself. Stand up for yourself. Don't worry about what the world thinks. Don't let the world put you into this box that you have to conform to. Learn to be self-assured. Learn to be self-confident. Build solid friendships and trust other people. And you can help make the world a better place, and you'll be a better person for having that kind of attitude through life. And ultimately, that's what the message of the movie is. Teamwork. You can't do it alone. You can't do it by yourself. But together, with all of your very different skill sets and all of your different weaknesses, together, you can achieve something that is great. And you have to learn to sacrifice together, to love together, to accept one another for your faults and your strengths. And if you do, you can succeed, and the world can be made a better place. And you can literally alter people's lives when you are in a mindset of self-sacrifice and putting the greater good above self-interest. And that's really the message of the film. And it's taught primarily in the game. When you have that first half of the first act with the young cast is primarily there to show you that these kids are in the middle of they are desperate. They are distant from one another. They are, the Power Rangers movie tried to do this too, to show that these people come from different backgrounds and from different stations in life and different economic classes and different social statuses, and they are really far apart. Even the Rock's character and Gillian's character as adults and their teenage counterparts, they're sort of similar. They run in the same social circles to an extent. They're both outsiders, but they still aren't connecting. They aren't close with each other in the real world in a way that you would think they would, given some of their similar interests. And of course, obviously, you have the stereotypical jock and cheerleader or a socialite. And the whole first act of that movie is meant to, or half of that first act for the kids, is meant to show you that in this life, in the real world, these four people are as separate as they can be. They've all known each other since they were young, but they grew up, life changed, people changed, time changed, and they went their separate ways and entered into different social circles, and the rules of high school and the cliques of high school spread them apart. What they have to do through the game is learn how to come back together. And that's where a lot of the film's messaging is in the game itself and in the jungle itself. Because they have to learn to work together in order to survive, to achieve the goal that they need to achieve to get back to reality. And the thing is, once they do, obviously, the take the skills and the responsibilities that they learned in the game and they apply it to their lives going forward. Choosing what kind of a person you want to be going forward. And that's really the profound and deep message that The Rock, the producers, the director, the actors, they all really wanted to send was, it's about who you want to be going forward. And so that was something that the cast and the message of the film were two things that I really, really enjoyed. The other thing that I really enjoyed was the score. I think that the movie, the music for this movie fits. It has a very 1990s, The Mummy, late 90s, early 2000s, Brendan Fraser, Mummy, action-adventure vibe to it. It has a very... It's not a bombastic score, but it's a very lively score. It's very action-adventure-y, very pulpy. It propels action forward, and it sounds really cool, and it fits the beat and the atmosphere, and it incorporates the drums that were so synonymous with the game in the first one. The score and the sound design and the sound mixing and the score itself really aid this film in a way that I really wasn't expecting. I'm not one who picks up on score very easily, but I did feel that music and the way it's employed and the way it's written is very, very key in aiding the film to its enjoyable, to it being enjoyable. So, if we've already talked about what I enjoyed about the film and what I liked about the film, let's dive into what I didn't like about the film. The first thing that I would think about when I talk about things I don't like about the film, and yes, I will address my ongoing rantings about Jumanji on the podcast in a little bit. But let's talk about the things I didn't like. The thing I didn't like the most was the villain. This guy makes a lot of Marvel's villains look weak, look strong. He is allegedly steeped in Jumanji history and lore. Which is another thing I really didn't like about the game, about the story overall, is that you added in a bunch of legendary history for Jumanji. You created the jungle where Alan Parrish was sucked into in the 1950s, and you're saying that there was this Indiana Jones level archaeology war between two characters over this jewel that sits at the heart of the jungle. Yet the hunter from the first movie is nowhere to be found, and he was the person who was doing the most damage to Alan while he was in the jungle. He was constantly pursuing Alan because Alan was the biggest game in Jumanji because he was the only human. That's the way things were structured from what we were told in the first movie. In this movie, there's plenty of human beings, there's a whole city, and there's this one creepy archaeologist guy who just wants the stone so that he can control all the animals of Jumanji for some reason, unbeknownst to me or God. And once he possesses the stone, he looks into it and he gets entrapped and ensnared by its power. And now he can control all the animals and make creepy bug things come out of his ears and his eyes. And, you know, he looks like something off The Walking Dead. He has henchmen, so he doesn't really do a lot of the action beats himself until the third act. And even in the third act, his positioning and posturing is very weak. And he's easily outmaneuvered and outplayed, which is, to me, problematic. Although, the argument, just like Marvel, can be made that, essentially, this movie was not about the hero, the villain. It was about the heroes, and in this case, the kids. And so you really didn't need a super strong villain. You just needed somebody for them to defeat. And I can get on board with that to an extent, because it is a video game movie. They go out of their way several times in the movie to have characters repeat the same line, even when they're interacted with, to show that they're, you know, they're only pre-programmed with certain statements. But I feel like the villain was a real weak point for me. I felt like if we'd have gotten a more dynamic villain with maybe even just as tragic a backstory as another character in the film has, maybe it would have made him a little bit more sympathetic and relatable. I think that would have aided the film quite a bit. But overall, the backstory, the history of Jumanji and this secret archaeology war, and the villain himself was not anything that to write home about, and it was, to me, one of the weaker points of the film. The other thing that I'd like to say that I didn't like very much, or I felt was bad, was the fact that the CGI was not... The 3D was done really well. The CGI was not, especially in anything dealing or interacting with the stone. There are certain set pieces here in here where the CGI completely took me out of the movie. And I can understand why. I mean, they had a budget, but they didn't have like $180 million budget the way a Marvel movie does. I felt like some of the CGI was shoddy, especially the set piece that comes to my mind most is the helicopter rhino scene with Rock having to climb out and get onto the top of the helicopter and fix it while they're being chased by rhinos. That rhino set piece really didn't work for me. It took me out of the movie because the CGI on the rhinos was so bad. And the death scenes in the rhino chase were so bad. So I really didn't care for the CGI in this film. I care for the 3D. This, again, is a film very similar to Ghostbusters in a lot of ways, not the least of which is the fact that the 3D here was really incorporated well, and it really aided everything in a positive way. So, you know, those are the things that I didn't like about the film. So let's talk about some of the things that I would change. There is a character that our heroes meet halfway through, who is another player who got sucked into the game years ago. The problem with this is a couple of things. Number one, they don't tell us whether he got sucked in by the board game or whether he got sucked in by the video game. Because, of course, the game evolved and became a video game after being shelved away as a board game, because it wanted to continue sucking kids in and being played, and so it evolved. It's great, understandable. But we don't know whether this kid was sucked into the game by the video game or the board game, which is it's a technicality, but it is a detail that I would have added in there. And one of the reasons I would have added it in there is because they choose to go the route of saying that this young man was sucked into the game in the year 1996. Why is 1996 applicable here? Why is it important? Well, because if the first film takes place in current day, present day, that means present day was 1995 or 96. So what you're telling me is that in the 1950s, because Alan Parrish defeats the game, everything resets, he goes back to the 1950s, where he started, they take the game, they throw it down the stream, kids on a beach find it, the drums beat, the game is found on the beach, screen goes black, that's the end of the first movie. We assume that that last shot of the movie is in the 1950s. Somewhere. There's not a lot to indicate whether or not that's the case, due to mainly the fact that you only see a brief glimpse of the kids. But and you can't really tell what they're wearing and whether that's present stuff or whether that's past stuff that they're wearing. So what's problematic for me is if you don't tell me whether or not he got sucked in by the game or whether he got sucked in by the video game, it creates a situation where I don't know how he got, you know, whether or not he was taken the same way Alan was taken. He takes up residence in the place, the treehouse, basically, the cantina, essentially, where Alan Parrish resided while he was in the jungle. Part of the problem I have with that is that the area is kind of out in an open space, which is seems to go against everything that Alan was saying when he came back out of the jungle about trying to hide and trying to stay hidden and not be in plain view because of the hunter constantly being on your trail. But to me, it is a technicality, but it is important to understanding when and how he got taken. Now, the 96 thing, like I said, is very interesting because Kirsten Dunst's character and her brother at the time of the at the time of 95-96, because of the new timeline that happened with Alan Parrish growing up, as he normally would have, instead of missing for 30 years, Parrish Shoes is still thriving, is a thriving shoe company in the mid-90s. Alan Parrish has this kept his parents' home. It's a nice, big, sprawling mansion. They have the Christmas party. They get the kids' parents' jobs, and they tell the kids' parents not to go on the ski trip, which led to them getting killed, which meant that the kids never lost their parents, which was good. But in that reality, Alan Parrish would have been a kid, a thriving adult in Massachusetts in the 90s when this kid was taken. Where was this kid when he was this kid present in Ohio? Was this kid present in Ohio in this little small bay town or whatever it is? Where these kids are living now, and is that in Ohio or is that in Massachusetts? Would Alan have heard the story? I guess what I'm trying to say is, I feel like if Alan Parrish in 1996 would have heard of a story of a kid going missing and a father on TV claiming that his son had gotten sucked into a game, that Alan Parrish would have went to the kid, where the kid's parents, wherever they were, and explain to them what probably happened to their son and how they could get their son back. And so that's why it's problematic for me setting him in 1996. So while the Cindy Crawford references and the the other 90s, mid-90s cultural references that they throw in there with him are nice and they're neat and they're fun, I would have said that he was sucked into the game in 2005 or 2010. Because it does a couple of things. One, it puts him closer to their age in proximity so that when he gets out and he lives his normal life from that starting point, the kind of budding relationship that Jack Black's would-be teenage hottie girl and him, she sacrifices her life. She gives him one of her lice to keep him alive so that they can get him out of the game. The creepy part of that is that she does it in hopes of hooking up with him, thinking that he would come out of the game as a 16-year-old, the way that he was presented in the game. The problem is, as we all know, when you get out of Jumanji, you start back from where you began. So he started back from 96 onward. And so we see him at the end of the film with his wife and his children in his minivan and his Christmas tree. And it's a disappointment to her because she sees him with his family and she knows that she has no shot ever. And it makes for this really creepy dynamic of a 30-something-year-old guy in a 15 or 16-year-old girl, and this kind of tension. So I would have said that he got sucked into the game in 2010, which would have made him closer in age to her so that it didn't feel as creepy. Now, that being said, I also understand why they did it, because they wanted her to see what an impact she made and her sacrifice made on him, on his life going forward as he grew up, or as he lived his life, by the fact that his mother, his daughter is named after her character. So I get why they did it. Like I said, it's something I would do differently. I would have structured it differently. Another thing that I would have done differently or structured differently would have been some of the comedic beats don't work, especially with Kevin Hart. And I kind of wish they would have toned his stuff down. I know it's his over-the-top nature is the attractiveness of having Kevin Hart in that role, but I really wish they would have toned him down a little bit. And another thing that I would have changed would have been the fact that when they meet that kid in the game and they hear the 90s references and they ask him how long, what year he was playing the game, and he tells them 1996, they never, over the course of the rest of the film, take an opportunity to tell him, hey, your dad never gave up on you. Your dad is still looking for you. He's still, your house is dilapidated. He looks embittered and old and stressed and cranky, and it's all because he lost you. This is a big deal in Jumanji terms about what the effects of losing a child are on parents. We see Alan Parrish's parents in a graveyard, dead, penniless, from trying to find their son, and sick with sadness about the fact that the last thing that they moments they had with their child were an argument. In this particular case, his parents are alive, and or his dad is alive, and the house is there. It's just dilapidated, and he even has a line in Jumanji in the game where he says, "My poor parents." And they don't take the opportunity to say, hey, your dad never gave up on you. Your dad kept looking for you. Your dad kept waiting for you to come home. He always had your room kept the same way that you had it when you left. He wanted you to come home. He spent every day missing you. Because that could have inspired him even more so to get out of the game, to want to go to his dad, to want to ease his dad's suffering. So that's something, again, that I would have changed. As far as things that, like, I enjoyed but could take or leave, I feel like they didn't do enough riddles. But what I liked about the riddles was the fact that they were instrumental in the same way they were instrumental in the original to helping them get along the pathway to where they needed to go. I would have changed the sidekicks of the villain. I would have made them a little smarter. I would have made them a little more cunning. I wouldn't have used motorcycle riders with helmets on their faces as the main, you know, force that are just there to be beat up. I'd at least have taking the helmets off of them so you can at least look into their faces and see their eyes and make them huge actual human beings instead of just punching bags. I like that every character gets his or her moment to shine. Again, that goes to the teamwork aspect of this movie and the message of this movie, that they can't do it alone. They each need each other. And the last thing that I would really change, honestly, would have been the climax of the film and the delay in yelling Jumanji. I feel like the guide had repeated himself four or five enough times to where the kids would have been aware that in order to solve the riddle of Jumanji, they had to say the name. And so that little delay and the post sequence where, you know, everybody's just shaking hands with the guide to get returned home, I would have had everybody just disapparate as they yelled Jumanji and have, because at that point it gives you 5 or 10 more minutes in the real world showing how these kids have changed over the course because of their experience. And so that's something that I would definitely have done if I could have changed things about the film. So where does this leave the Save the Jumanji franchise going forward? Well, first of all, we know that the movie is making a lot of money. It's going to do open to over $50 million. Force Awakens is going to have a huge drop of over 60%. The Last Jedi is going to have a drop of over 60%. It'll still be in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and Jumanji will do very well, $50 to $60 million opening weekend. Again, on a budget that's not exorbitant. It's not huge. So that's a good thing. And it will probably encourage Sony to fast-track more movies. The problem that you have is, how does the game evolve next? The game took the shape of a Super Nintendo-like, PlayStation-like game console that they found when they were in the detention, in the basement, cleaning out what was going to be a computer lab for the principal. They hear the drum beats of the game when at the end of the movie, and instead of doing what Alan Parrish and his friend do in the first movie, which is throw it in a river, box it up, throw it in a river, and hope it finds somebody else, or that they never see it again. Instead, what they did was they beat it to pieces. And they beat it to pieces with a baseball bat. We see it lying in pieces on the ground as they walk away. The drums stop. So, with the game technically destroyed, and if you want to do sequels, which I'm sure that they do, if this is as profitable as it seems like it's going to be, what they need to do is find a way for the game to evolve. And to me, the only way for the game to evolve is for it to either be on the internet or for it to be on your phone, which would be another, as an app, as a way to suck millions of more kids in, literally. So that's the issue with the series going forward. The other issue with the series going forward is how much more of the world of Jumanji can be explored. There was this map, and the parts of Jumanji that you saw, there was of course a tribal city of some kind that had a marketplace. But other than that, it looked like vast jungle with rain, waterfalls, and forest and animals of wildness all around. It didn't look like a particularly hospitable place for human beings. So if we saw the vast majority of Jumanji because they had to walk across it basically to get to the jaguar, which was in the center of Jumanji, well, what's going to happen next? Because you can't repeat the same thing. You can't have a new group of kids come in and basically have to navigate the jungle with new avatars. The possibility would be that it's like Pandora. One of the things that Cameron has talked about with his Avatar movies is that there are multiple places he wants to explore. You know, we really only explored the sky and some of the land of Forest of Pandora. At least in Avatar 2, we're going to explore the water and the seas and the oceans of Pandora. Well, maybe we didn't explore the deserts or the the deserts or the rivers or the oceans of Jumanji. Maybe there is more to Jumanji than just what was on the map and just what they saw in this film, and that it is actually a multicultural, multi-climated place. And if that's the case, and that could very easily be the case in a new film, in a new version of the game, I could very easily accept that. And I think that that would be the way to go if you want to make the film successful. What's going to be interesting is with The Rock and Jillian and Black and all of these people being avatars, their performances could change and be more nuanced, because the new kids who would inhabit those avatars would be having new issues that they would have to be exploring. And one of the things that I think would be really interesting if you're going to do another Jumanji is, instead of having kids get sucked in the game the way that we've had with the two Jumanji films and with Zortha, what I would do is I would have 30-somethings sucked into the game. You know, we do a lot of 90s nostalgia and 80s nostalgia now. Well, try pulling some of those kids who grew up on that stuff back into the game, and let them work through their adult issues together through Jumanji. If Jumanji is supposed to be essentially a relationship-building life lesson, the way that it was in the first movie and the second movie, well, there's a lot of differences and there's a lot of issues that adults have that they need to work through. And I think that they could do that very easily and have a good message for adults in a Jumanji film that is centered around them and the issues that they're facing midlife crisis point of their lives. So if you're going to continue the Jumanji franchise, I think that that's the way you do it. The game evolves onto phones or the internet, and you get adults sucked in, 30-somethings, 30 people between the ages of 25 and 35 sucked into the game, which I think would be a really interesting and different dynamic. Now, let me address the so-called or supposed elephant in the room here. I have been ranting about this movie for a long time on the podcast. I had several people who I've bumped into on the streets who've listened to the podcast on a regular basis. Thank you very much, first of all. Second of all, they asked me, is it a work? Do you really not care about the Jumanji movie, but you're just working yourself up on the podcast to kind of get ratings or seem bombastic or to play a part, play a joke? And the truth is, it doesn't. It's not. I love that original Jumanji movie, and it means a whole lot to me because of what it stands for and because of the meaning behind it and because of the message of it and because of Robin Williams' performance. The CGI is crappy, and the performances aren't great except for Williams and except for the two adults, really. But it's a great movie with a great message, because it's him having the first Jumanji is a movie about facing your fears, and every one of those four main characters have to face their fears at some point in the game and overcome them in order to finish the game and get back the life that was taken from them. And I really like Robin Williams' nuanced performance, because he does play as a broken, damaged man-child who has come out of this game and is now trying to live his life. And so I like his evolution of how he comes to care for the kids. I like the responsibility that he takes for the kids. I like that whole journey, and I like him coming to terms with his own fears in that film. And so that first film has a lot of meaning and resonance to me because I read it in a way that's probably different from the way almost everyone else reads that film. So it's not a work. It is in fact a shoot. I do care very passionately about the first movie, and I really did feel like this movie was just being made and to restart a franchise. They didn't really care about the first movie, and that they just kind of shoehorned Alan Parrish's name in there just to kind of have sentimental value. And the truth is that that is true to some extent. Alan Parrish's name is only mentioned once. It's shown once, written or carved into the place where the pilot character is residing. He says it's Alan Parrish's house. I'm just staying in it. And so to an extent, it was true. But whereas the first movie was all about learning to overcome your fears, the second movie is really all about bridging your differences and learning to work together as a team and appreciating the fact that everybody has different strengths and different weaknesses, and those don't make us bad people. That doesn't make us weak individuals. It makes us stronger individuals, because if the world was all homogenous, what a horrific and very boring place that would be to live. And so the film has just as powerful and just as potent and just as important and just as profound a message as the first film did. So in that respect, I'm okay with it. This movie, in a lot of ways, is very much to me like Ghostbusters. I ranted about Ghostbusters, and I was very upfront in that podcast last July about the fact that, you know, if Ghostbusters had never been a thing, and there'd never been a thing in the 80s about made two films made in the 80s, and Ghostbusters was just a thing that came out in July of 2016 and had a cast of really funny women, and it was perpetuating a message about power and about femininity and about owning your nerdiness and owning the fact that you can be the smartest person in the room, even if you're a female, that your gender doesn't matter, that smart is smart, and it pays to be smart. That if there had been no prior Ghostbusters movie, that this movie would probably make a lot more money than it did, and would probably have been a lot more well-received than it was. And that's the way I feel about this movie for me. For all intents and purposes, as I said, the only reference really to the first movie is the Alan Parrish. They take the drum beats, which come from the book. They took the riddle, the first opening riddle, they took directly from the book, as it is in the first movie. And they took the aesthetic of and design of the Jumanji logo from the book and the first movie. But those are all things that, for the most part, you would have to have in a Jumanji film if you were basing it on the book. So, in all actuality, if Robin Williams had never starred in a Jumanji movie in 1995, and this movie came out, I think it would do exactly what it's doing now. I think it would make money. I think people would like it. The critics would enjoy it because it is... it's not dumb fun. It's smart, funny, and it has a great message. I just think that if you didn't have the preconception, like, if you took Alan Parrish's name out of this film, that's the only intangible connection to the original film that there is in this film, in this movie, and you just called it Jumanji, and you just called it Welcome to the Jungle, and called it some other name, say, Hoops and Hearts. Let's just say the name of the game was Hoops and Hearts. I think a lot of people would embrace it and think that it was awesome. I think the Jumanji name and basing it off the Jumanji book and making statements about how important the first film is to you and how, you know, you met Robin Williams one time and he hugged you and that makes it okay to do this film. I think those conversations lend it to an expectation of standard of being judged directly against the original. Now, I will say this. If you do judge this film directly next to the original, it holds up very well. And it holds its own very well because it continues the tradition of having a message and having an important theme and challenging its actors and challenging its audience to be introspective about their own lives. And so it does, and it has an action-adventure beat to it. It has some dramatic moments, far less than the original, but it would hold up. And that is an impressive statement. To me, as a fan of this material, as a fan of the first movie, I was very pleasantly surprised to find that this film really does hold up against the original and is very much worthy of the Jumanji name. And like I said, I think there are some really interesting and different and weird things you can do with a Jumanji film as you go forward. And I'd like to take this opportunity to very personally and humbly and sincerely apologize to The Rock. I've been kind of nagging at him and bugging him on Twitter, and I've been going off ranting at different people who Chad has been tweeting at me their reactions about this film. You were right. You made a film that was worthy of Robin Williams' legacy, and you made a film that was worthy of the Jumanji legacy and the Jumanji name. And I really do hope that you guys continue to go on this adventure and continue to tell stories that force viewers to take a look at themselves and their own lives and make films that have a resonance with generations of viewers. I hold the John Hughes classics to be in high regard, and one of the main reasons that I do that is because they are timeless in the fact that the adolescent experience doesn't change. Every year, every decade, every moment that passes, the teenage experience changes a little, but the overall aspect of it, the overall arc of it, doesn't change. The emotions we experience, the awkwardness, the out-of-placeness, the social hierarchy and the fight against that, all of those things are universal. And if we can continue to make Jumanji films that comment on whether it be fears, whether it be divisions like in this movie, social divisions like they do in this movie, or, you know, the complexities of growing up, the way that, you know, in our early to mid-30s, late 20s, we have to face, I think those messages and that introspection would be something that would be really interesting and I think really worth exploring in future movies. So I apologize to The Rock, I apologize to Sony, and I would be more than happy to support this film with more of my money and go to multiple viewings. So those are my thoughts on Jumanji. Welcome to the Jungle. It is a worthy ancestor of the Jumanji name, and I look forward to many more. So as we close out this podcast, as I said, next week we will be back with our normal format, with our normal co-host, Chad Metz, and we will talk at length about what we enjoyed about the films of 2017 and what we're looking forward to in 2018. And as we prepare to close this podcast, let me give you some final thoughts on the state of the Star Wars universe. I want to thoroughly reach out and implore Kathleen Kennedy and Lucasfilm not to course correct based on what is going on the internet right now. I'm proud of Rian Johnston for coming out and saying what needs to be said in a very respectful manner about Star Wars needing to move to continue to grow and expand, and that this is the way to do it. A lot of fans are mad online. Some of them are mad in person. I understand that. But the issue that I have is this. If you are a Star Wars fan out there, and you are holding out anger and bitterness and resentment toward Disney for taking the expanded universe and making it Legends and saying none of it existed and creating their own canon starting in 2012 with every book and every Battlefront game and every Marvel comic that they've released since 2012 being canon. Meanwhile, all the EU stuff that's been put out since 1989 is now gone. Get over it. They made it very, very clear to you from 2012 on that they were not going to put to the screen those stories. That they may call parts of them, they may call storylines, they may call character names. But the events of the expanded universe as they unfolded through multiple authors in multiple formats did not happen. Jason and Jaina Solo didn't happen. Marla Jade and Luke did not happen. Luke's kid did not happen. The Knights of the Old Republic didn't happen. These are all things that they've made implicitly clear that they were not going to put in full form in chapter and verse, beat for beat, those stories on the silver screen. So if you walked into The Last Jedi expecting to see the version of Luke Skywalker the way he was depicted in the expanded universe, if you expected Rey to be Jaina Solo or Rey Solo, if you had this idea of the way Luke was in the expanded universe after Return of the Jedi, and you're mad because you didn't get that, you should have made your peace with that a long time ago. 75 to 85% of the Star Wars fan base, 75 to 85% of the people Lucasfilm and Disney are targeting for these movies, their general audience demographic, has no idea that there's thousands of books and comics and TV shows out there about what happened between the Return of the Jedi, what happened after Return of the Jedi, and they have that whole story out there. They don't know that. And so to expect that Disney's just going to take all of this and adapt it beat for beat and then when they don't do it to get mad at them is ludicrous. They are building a new narrative. They are creating a new timeline. They are creating a new reality. And in this reality, two movies, three movies in, because you count Rogue One filling in the gaps between three and four, and Rebels, this is their new canon. These are the new stories. And this is how it happens in this reality. If you're waiting with bated breath for them to take every action beat of the expanded universe and make it onto screen, you're going to be pissed for the rest of your life, because they're never going to do that, because that is deep level nerd stuff that's not going to work for a general audience. And even if they did it, even if they took those tenets and ideas and characters and put them on the screen, they would still have to tweak them for a general audience, and you would still be pissed at them for not doing it faithfully. Yet, you're perfectly okay and will spend money after money after money to see Age of Ultron. You will spend lots of money on Infinity War. Both Avengers movies, which will not follow the comic book, adhere it. They will not adhere to the comic book beat for beat. So while I understand and appreciate your desire to see the EU come to life, Lucasfilm told you that wasn't going to happen in 2012. So you need to be should have been in a place to accept that these were the new stories. And if you want to say that the new canon that Rian Johnson and J.J. Abrams and Lawrence Kasdan and Kathleen Kennedy and Pablo Hidalgo are writing is not as good or not as accurate or not as faithful to what Star Wars is as the expanded universe was, that's okay. That's your opinion. If you want to say that Luke should have gotten off the island and sacrificed himself in person and not just force projected himself across the galaxy, that's a valid argument. But know that going forward in episode 9, and I am imploring Lucasfilm to stay the course, you're not going to get the EU Star Wars that you want. And the sooner that you learn to accept that, the better off you're going to be. And I applaud Rian Johnson for being really weird and really different, which is something a lot of people wanted after Force Awakens. And I applaud him for making the artistic choices, even at the expense of some of the artists that were collaborating with him. Because I think that he's right. That is what Star Wars needs in order to expand and grow. So there you have it. Those are my thoughts on the internet outrage over Star Wars The Last Jedi. And those are my thoughts on Jumanji Welcome to the Jungle. We will be back next week. And until then, have a very Merry Christmas, and we'll talk to you again next week.